Good afternoon. We would like to note first for the record that Justice Pickering is with us. She is on video at the Regional Justice Center in Las Vegas. I believe that you can see her below me. We are here in the matter of Kincaid versus State, case number 63563. Are the parties ready to proceed?
Yes.
Very well. Mr. Frenner?
Dylan Frainer, on behalf of Michael Kincaid. We are here today to ask for this court to protect Kincaid's fundamental rights. A defendant has the fundamental right under the Nevada and the U.S. Constitution to present witnesses in his own behalf, to confront and cross-examine the witnesses against him, and ultimately to have a fair trial. This court has noted that it's the court's responsibilities to carefully guard against dilution of these rights. Especially in Abbott versus State, this court heard a similar case involving children. And in that case, it specifically stated, sex crimes against children are extremely upsetting, and our legislature placed a very severe punishment to fit the crime. As such, it is vitally important that if this penalty is imposed, it is imposed only on a defendant deserving of the punishment. This can only be assured where the defendant is given a meaningful opportunity to present his defense. All the errors that Mr. Kincaid has raised in this appeal go to the fact that he was not able to present a meaningful defense in his case. The linchpin of the case begins in August of 2011, when Officer Cowley took Mr. Kincaid's 12-year-old grandson, who had been living with him for the past 2 to 3 years. She took him into an enclosed room, no windows, just her and him, where she began to interview him with regards to other allegations made by two other children. During the process of that interview, for 2 hours, this young 12-year-old boy denied that anything happened. Yet for 2 hours, Officer Cowley continued to berate him, saying that she knew that he wasn't telling the truth, that he was lying. She continued to tell him about the other stories of the other children, other adults who had made allegations against Mr. Kincaid, told him that he needed to come forward to protect these other kids from having anything else happen to them, told him that she could get help for Mr. Kincaid. She would talk quietly, put her hand on his knee, and told him that he could do it. He could do this. But if he didn't and he denied, she would continue to tell him that he was lying. Over the course of this 2 hours of breaking every technical aspect of what you're not supposed to do when interviewing a child, finally, after the end of 2 hours, this young child said, well, he broke down. He started crying and said, well, the same thing happened to me, and didn't provide any details of the actual allegation. Once those 2 hours was up, he was then free to leave the room. He was placed with other relatives, and that became the catalyst of everything that happened with Mr. Kincaid. As we began the trial, we asked for an opportunity to be able to present or to have the children independently evaluated in accordance with Abbott and Kortschner. We asked for this opportunity, and when the court reviewed the evidence, the one thing that they pointed to in denying it was saying, well, there's corroboration. The 12-year-old NH, as we call him in the briefs, he supports the allegations by VK. They corroborate each other. And because there's corroboration, we don't think there's justification to do an evaluation. And so we have a forced corroboration by an officer. And yet, based upon this forced corroboration, when the defendant asked for an independent evaluation, the opportunity to interview both children, he's denied that opportunity. And just as is specified in Abbott, he was denied the opportunity to move forward with his case.
Now, the district court also made a determination that Kincaid had not presented adequate reasons to question the victim's veracity, correct?
He did. That's correct. And the evidence that we had presented to show the veracity, first with the first child, BK, was the were the facts surrounding his disclosure. The alleged incident happened in 2009. He didn't disclose until 2011. 2 months before his disclosure, he had an event where he was extremely angry at his father. His favorite aunt was arrested right in front of his eyes, and his father was there. He came out screaming at his father, telling him that he hated him. And even at trial, he admitted that he had never been so angry at him ever before in his life. And then a month later, his mom starts talking to him about finding child porn on Mr. Kincaid's computer 10 years before. After these instances is when he finally discloses. And so we can see that there was anger, there was issues of, there was issues with regards to custody dispute, there was disclosures, and then there was also evidence that BK had previously been involved in sexual activity, which if you go back to the case in Abbott, there is some discussion with regards to that. And that's one of the reasons why the veracity was questioned in Abbott is because the child had been exposed to prior sexual instances and had acted on them, similar to what BK had done in this event. With regards to NH, we believe that the veracity was shown as well, just for the fact that when he was put on at preliminary hearing and asked questions about what was going on and his allegations, he continued to grow his allegations. And when we tried to pin him down with what was going on in those allegations, he said he couldn't remember if it was a dream or not. He didn't know if it was real. He didn't actually know or see Mr. Kincaid do it because he said it was dark every time that it happened. But every time that it happened, it was also times that BK was present with NH. And so there was a lot of issues that went to the veracity. The court very succinctly said there was nothing and moved on, mostly because it spent most of its time dealing with the corroboration.
There were other factors that you didn't mention, such as the fact that he detected cigarette smoke, and Mr. Kincaid was a smoker. There were other factors such as that.
I don't remember that fact.
No?
No.
It's there somewhere.
Okay. And it was my knowledge that Mr. Kincaid is not a smoker.
Okay.
So. But that's the linchpin of what began with the corroboration, because the court then relies upon that throughout the remainder of some of its arguments. Mr. Kincaid went on to, because he wouldn't have an opportunity to independently evaluate the children, we filed several other motions. We asked to have the charges severed for the fact that we knew that there was going to be, there wasn't clear and convincing evidence on either side, whether it be with the sexual assault or the internet charges. Again, the court relied upon the corroboration, saying that that made it clear and convincing of the sexual assault. They should be admissible with regards to the internet charges. And then on the internet charges, very interesting is that there was a lot of question. At that hearing, the court specifically said, I don't understand all this. Would it help if we had an expert here? And we said, yes, we would like to have an expert. We'd like to present that evidence. The court hadn't granted Mr. Kincaid one at that point in time. But yet still the court went ahead, even after we had requested to present expert evidence on those, and ruled that there was clear and convincing evidence on everything, it was admissible, as well as the prior bad acts. Once those
I apologize for the awkwardness of the video, but I had a question for you on the last point, and that is that the state did use two experts, Cowley and Behrman-Lippert. I understand what Cowley testified to, but on the point of whether your motion to have an independent evaluation of the children done, what did Behrman-Lippert testify to? Or how did the state use that doctor?
Dr. Lippert's testimony was based upon her evaluation of the children to indicate that their responses, their demeanor, everything about them was consistent with a child that had been sexually assaulted.
So she had she got to interview the children. I mean, it was a face-to-face interview with them that she then testified to the results, or did she view the Cowley tape of the interview?
No, she actually interviewed the children twice. She
okay.
did 2 one-hour interviews with each of the children, I believe, on 2 occasions in November. And then she was able
Thank
to
you.
Present that evidence to the trial.
What, to the jury.
To the jury, yes.
What was the issue of the children's veracity in your mind, adequately presented to the jury? I mean, indeed, the jury had the opportunity to assess these children and the nature of their testimony. Is that a fair statement?
I don't believe so, no.
But they did testify.
They did testify, yes. But at that point in time, without being able to have an independent evaluation of our own, the only way that we can really dig into their testimony is on the stand in front of the jury. And after talking to several of the jury members, they indicated, you know, you can't be mean to a child.
You were not precluded in any way from challenging the victims in this case, or the victim witnesses in this case, in terms of a typical cross-examination, where, in fact, trial lawyers often use cross-examination to point out lack of veracity or something of that nature. You were not in any way precluded from doing that, were you?
No, I was not, other than the fact that, again, in front of a jury, you have to be very careful with a child on the stand. And to be able to completely cross-examine them, all you can do is pretty much ask them the questions that they have and try to show the differences in prior testimony to get into the full detail of why they made the statements, similar to what the state did, where you get 2 hours to sit a child down and force-feed them information you want. That's not what we were asking to do, but that's the opportunity that they had.
You were able to ask the children whether or not they were mad at this particular, at your client, correct?
We were.
Whether or not they had some other reason, in whether family members had influenced them, you were able to ask those questions, were you not?
We were, correct.
Thank you.
And then the expert you put up, Dr. Chambers. Dr. Chambers never actually got to interview the kids, right? I mean, that's the... So Dr. Chambers testifies without knowing, having interviewed the children, whereas the state's two experts had fairly extensive interviews with them. Is that fair?
That's fair. The only thing that Dr. Chambers was able to do was to review the videos of the interviews and then also the transcripts, and then he was able to offer his opinion based upon his review of those without having interviewed the children directly.
Thank you.
But you don't dispute
that. Was that made anything of it at trial? I'm sorry. That your expert had no face-to-face contact with these children, whereas the state's had superior access?
As an issue to the jury, no, it was not.
Okay.
With regards to the judge, we didn't bring it up there because he had ruled previously that we weren't able to do it, so we didn't re-raise it at that point in time.
Right. Thank you.
You also don't debate that the Kirshner case talks about that exactly the mere suggestion of family influence is not enough to at least support what you would need to get the evaluation. That's law is still good, is it not?
I don't dispute just the mere allegation of family influence. That's correct.
Okay.
But I believe that we have much more here, where it's not just family influence. There was a complete angering event. There were also issues with regards to custody disputes going on at the same time. And so we believe there was a lot more. And then when you get to the other child, his inability to remember whether it was a dream or something in reality, obviously there's something there with regards to his mentality, and maybe he doesn't know that it's affecting his veracity. But that's where an independent evaluation would certainly help to understand what was going on in that child's mind.
Yeah.
Certainly there are many more issues. My time is limited to 2 minutes. But I think the next most important issue, obviously we asked for an opportunity to go into the prior sexual allegations. Those were denied based upon the rape shield law. We believe that the court misapplied that in the fact that, similar to prior bad act evidence, there are other instances where the rape shield law does not apply, and you're looking at introducing evidence of knowledge, motive, intent, and we believe that sufficient facts were shown to the court to show that BK, who had participated in similar activity, sexual activity, prior to this incident, namely the humping game with his older brother, had the opportunity and knowledge of what was going on, and that his presence during all the allegations from NH made it applicable to be able to bring up that prior sexual activity before the jury and allow them to weigh that evidence. When we got to trial, certainly there were multiple evidentiary issues. The state had not filed the proper notice with regards to having an officer testify as an expert on child erotica. They had misapplied that in the state, and the court recognized that, but regardless, when we opposed that, the state said, well, we don't see any bad faith, and defense, you should have been prepared for this anyway, we're going to let it come in. The only reason that the court indicated we should have been prepared is, for 3 months earlier, this officer had testified in about two sentences that she believed some of these pictures were child erotica. And based upon that, we were supposed to be prepared for trial for a whole thing on child erotica. There was no notice given that she was going to testify on child erotica, but yet she was allowed to testify at trial on that issue. And even then, she wasn't qualified as an expert in child erotica. She had, in all of her great experience, this was her first case dealing with child porn and child erotica. Yet the court still allowed her to testify, even though it wouldn't have assisted the trial, because she testified that there were two pictures that she believed were child erotica that were found in deleted files on a computer. And so we believe that the court erred in doing that. The court also allowed an affidavit to come in with regards to a report. Again, 10 days notice was not given prior to trial that the affidavit would be used. We were preparing for a witness, and it had a specific purpose for interviewing that witness. And then finally, also, the court allowed pictures to come in without proper authentication.
Mr. Frenner, I am only the acting presiding judge this afternoon. Justice Pickering is, in fact, the presiding judge of this panel, and she has graciously asked that Justice Pickering and I share that responsibility today because we are live with you. But with my colleague's concurrence, I think that we can give you another 2 minutes in rebuttal, even though you've exhausted your time here. I'll add 2 minutes to the respondent as well, but I also think Justice Pickering might have a follow-up question.
I did, and I apologize. I thank you for doing that, Justice Seda, because I think I'm eating up counsel's time a bit with the awkwardness of the video. I had one more question, and it was the point he was addressing last. And I would ask him to comment on the evidence that supported the child porn charges, the computer access of child pornography charges, because as I read the brief, the point was that he was convicted on propensity, not proof. And I wanted to hear from counsel for both sides on that point.
Yes, with regards to the evidence that was submitted at trial with regards to the child pornography, the main evidence that was submitted by the state was with regards to an internet history from the defendant's work computer. The internet history had a full listing of all internet sites that were accessed by the computer. And when you go through that, and this was presented at trial, it shows that there were 7 specific sites out of thousands that were charged as containing child pornography. Each of those sites that was alleged had multiple other sites that also showed at the exact same time as being visited by the computer. There was testimony from both experts that indicated that if you were to go to an actual website, that any pictures on that website would automatically be downloaded to your computer in a temporary internet file. The state's expert was able to pull the pictures from the work computer, but none of the pictures from the work computer matched those found on the websites. And so the only evidence that was truly there was the actual internet history that showed the multiple sites being hit at the same time. The state's argument is that there were also searches taken from the work computer that indicate that Mr. Kincaid was searching for child pornography. And while they may indicate he was searching for child pornography, if you looked at the dates that those were done, because there was a specific date on each of those searches, none of them coincided with the dates that the computer was alleged to have visited these 7 alleged sites. And so the only way that they could show this and argue that this is showing proof that he visited these 7 sites is propensity. He did this in 2010. He must have done it in 2011.
Thank you, Mr. Frenner. I'm going to allow the other side to state their side of the case at this point. And again, additional 2 minutes, please, for the respondent.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Daniel Hoagie, District Attorney for Lincoln County, representing the state. Discretion. This case is about the discretion granted to every trial judge in Nevada to weigh the competing interests of the various parties and ensure that a trial is both just and efficient. Here, the defendant was convicted of viewing child pornography on the internet and also sexually assaulting 2 boys who trusted in him. During trial, he made various motions, and many were granted, some were not, such as a motion to compel the 2 boys to undergo a psychological evaluation, a motion to hold 2 separate trials, a motion to introduce prior abuse to one of the boys. The issue then is whether or not Judge DeBrescu, in this case, abused the discretion granted to him. Did he act arbitrarily or capriciously, or did he review the case law, apply the facts to the case law, and issue a reasonable decision? I will show you that Judge DeBrescu did thoughtfully consider each of the defendant's requests and ruled only after careful scrutiny of the law, the case law, and the facts. First of all, a couple of facts I'd like to point out in the case. E.K. was born in 1997. At the time of trial, he was 14 years old. N.H. was born in 1998. At the time of trial, he was 13 years old. And that's very important for later on. Also, with regards to the sexual assault and the corroboration, it's important to note that BK, although he was a son, a biological son of the defendant, he lived in Las Vegas with his mother and only visited the defendant occasionally, rarely. NH, on the other hand, he was an adoptive grandson, but he lived alone with the defendant for most of the work week in the month, alone with the defendant in Panaca, Nevada, in a rural area on what he called the ranch. And that's very significant for how the two would disclose in this case. And so we go first to the defendant's motion to compel a psychological evaluation. If you look at Judge DeBrescu's decision in the record, it starts at page 343. Judge DeBrescu looks at all of the factors in Hirschman and in Abbott. He weighs all of the factors. He considers it. Did the state have experts? He said, yes, the state has experts, had two experts. I understand that, and that weighs in favor of the defendant. He recognized that point of law. He acknowledged that point of law. Corroboration. And this really is, as the defense states, the linchpin of their case. The two boys, the way that they disclosed, one in Las Vegas who disclosed, he had only been assaulted one time. And he disclosed in Las Vegas, but the way he disclosed, he said, I was sexually assaulted, but with NH. Now, NH, they were not together. They had no time to corroborate their stories or to get together or to act complicitly in any fabrication after the incidents. They were completely separated and isolated. But he said, I was sexually assaulted with NH. Now, NH was still in Panaca at the time, and NH, being alone with the defendant, said, no, I wasn't. And so Judge DeBrescu, in reviewing that, he said that is, according to his words exactly, powerful corroboration, because there was no opportunity for them to get together and fabricate a story. You look at NH's disclosure. This is very important as well, because in the trial court's review, the trial court stated, and I'll read directly from Judge DeBrescu's opinion, the court has listened to the entire recording of Callie's interview with NH, and the court finds that NH was not coerced. That was a finding of fact made by the trial court, was not coerced. And he makes that point several times in this five-page opinion or order. And so, was that thoughtfully considered? Yes, it was. And the jury also was able to review the interview with Detective Callie. And neither the jury nor the judge agreed with the defendant's view that NH had been coerced. In fact, it's quite the opposite. The trial court, Judge DeBrescu, says that it was very clear, the interview makes clear that NH wanted to protect the defendant. He was living alone with the defendant. He wanted to protect him and did not want to tell. He finally told the truth when he believed the defendant would get help. And you can see from the interview, he wrote a letter, said, I'm sorry, I finally broke down. He had to tell the truth. And so that was powerful corroboration, as Judge DeBrescu stated. Mental or emotional state, again, There was nothing that the defendant presented to show that there was a mental or emotional state that affected the veracity. He stated that, well, the victims were mad. But it would be logical to assume that if a child was molested by their father or grandfather, they would be angry. That's not a mental or emotional defect. That's a normal behavior. And so Judge DeBrescu, in the end, he reviewed the Kirshner and Abbott factors. He did what this court has requested every trial court do, review those factors, analyze those factors, and weigh the facts according to those factors. And he issued his decision. The one thing I would add is that the defendant was, the trial court did not grant the defendant the opportunity to have an expert interview the boys, but he did grant the defendant the request to have an expert. And the expert was provided with over 30 sources of data. All of the interviews that the boys had, all of the video recordings of the boys, all of the witnesses' statements, he had all of that data. And so if you look back and you ask, well, what more was the defendant going to ask, or what more was the defendant going to achieve with a private interrogation of the two boys? The defense has not proffered that. We don't know what more he could have done.
Could I ask you a question about the corroboration piece of this? And everyone, the district judge and you as well, seem to lay emphasis on the fact that the two boys were separated yet produced essentially the same allegations. The question I have, and it's a simple one, why couldn't they talk on the phone to one another? I mean, in crediting that powerful corroboration, that's the question that keeps occurring to me.
It's true that they could have, I guess, and you really have to see the witnesses and the family dynamics to see that that just never happened.
Was that anything that was brought up during the trial?
Yes, it was. It
the
was
telephone, the fact that they could have phoned each other?
Not the telephone exactly, but the fact that both boys were questioned about the fact that, did you ever communicate with each other? And they had, on rare instances, communicated with each other, but with family members around to the point where they weren't able to discuss private matters like that. Both of them stated that they were never given the opportunity to meet privately together and discuss what had happened. So we go to joinder. Again, if you look at Judge DeBrescu's decision, he goes over the case law. He researches the case law. He looks up NRS 173-115. He looks up Weber v. State, and he looks at all the factors. He looks at the Tench factors. We look at whether it's relevant, whether there's clear and convincing evidence, whether the probative value is outweighed by the prejudicial effect. He looks at all those factors, and he evaluates all those factors. He goes through a lengthy discussion in his order and reviews all the facts. One thing that's important is he looked at, for example, relevance. In this very court in Zanna v. State, he notes, viewed a very similar case and said that it was relevant in that case. When you have pornography charges and you have a sexually related crime, the one is relevant to the other and vice versa because of, the court says, the sexual appetite. I can't remember the exact words, but this court said it's evidence that one or the other is present to satiate the sexual appetite of the defendant. And so clearly this court has recognized that it is very relevant. I'm very probative of the defendant's state of mind, and I would note that these are both specific intent crimes, and that's an element that the state has to prove, has to establish that intent, what's going through his mind. And so that's very important for the state to be able to examine what's in his mind so that the defendant can't say, well, these are all pop-ups, this was an accident, I didn't want to view pornography, and vice versa for the sexual assaults. And so clearly it's probative and relevant, and the question is prejudicial, and that, again, the judge weighed the factors, reviewed it, and said that although there would be some prejudice. The prejudice does not outweigh the probative value. And so clearly there was no abuse of discretion. He thoughtfully considered it. He scrutinized the law and the facts and made his decision. And the third or major issue is the rape shield law. And again, Judge DeBrescu recognized that the rape shield law does conflict with a defendant's right to confront witnesses. And that's what this court has said, and he recognized that. And so according to NRS 50.090, the defendant can't present evidence of any previous sexual conduct of the victim, but also there's that right to confront witnesses. And so the trial court looked at Summit v. State, looked at the factors, and again, it was whether or not it's relevant. And when you look at relevance, in this case, as I stated, the boys were 14 and 13. And if you look at all the case law, rarely, rarely will you ever find a case in which the sexual innocence inference was ever applied to anyone over 12 years old. It just rarely ever happens. These boys were 14 and 13, and to say that the jury would automatically assume that there was sexual innocence in this day and age is a very difficult assumption to automatically take. And Judge DeBrescu, in his order, he specifically asked the court for some more clarification on that. If you read his order, he said it's very difficult to know when to apply that assumption. Do we automatically assume every child under 18, for example, is a sexual innocent? Do we automatically assume? No court, except on rare occasions, has ever assumed that anyone under the age of 12 is a sexual innocent. And so for a 14 and 13-year-old boy, the majority of all courts state that that is not an inference that the jury will take. And if you look at Summit v. State, you've got a 6-year-old girl. And I believe there was a case in Nevada I did find where there was a 13-year-old girl, but there was other extenuating circumstances. And that was more of the exception than the rule. And so to be relevant, the defendant really has to establish that at the time of trial, the victim had knowledge beyond their years, and that victim was a sexual innocent and could not have given that description without some sort of former abuse. And that's not the case here. In order to even meet the very first prong of Summit v. State, there has to be that inference. There has to be relevance, and there was no relevance established in this case.
Could I ask you a question on that? As I read the briefs, the argument was that BK's brother perpetrated sex acts on BK, and I may have the initials wrong, it's hard, that BK's encounter with MH could have mirrored, so that the theory for the defense was it was relevant and it wasn't to show bad moral character or propensity on BK's part, rather it was to show that MH may be confusing what went on with him and BK in the dark with what went on with him and Kincaid in the dark, if you will. Could you comment on that, please?
Yeah, absolutely. That was an argument also made by defense. It's a little distinct from Summit v. State. It's not the sexual innocence inference. But I would also argue that it's not relevant in that what you're really getting at is a general credibility attack. What you're saying is because this happened to this boy one time, therefore you cannot believe this boy. This boy probably did it to this other boy this next time. And so in order for it to be relevant, it has to be more probable than not that that happened. There has to be some sort of probability that happened. And so in that case, you really are arguing just general credibility. You're arguing propensity. Well, he did that previously, or he was previously sexually molested, and they called it the humping game. His older brother, Mikey Jr., molested him and taught him how to do this humping game. So he was probably doing the humping game with his older brother. And the reason that's not relevant is because you're talking about years that had elapsed since that time. And he's obviously older. He also went through the judicial process with his older brother, so he knew that it was wrong at that point. He knew that his older brother got into a lot of trouble. And so he knew that the humping game was not right, and that had affected him very significantly. And so that was the inference that, oh, well, he had done it in the past, and now he will do it in the future, was a false inference. That it was not relevant. It was just a general attack on credibility.
Counsel, I would note that you rely significantly on the findings that Judge Dabrowski made in this case, and I would agree with you that he made some very careful and considered reviews and analysis of facts to the law. But in his order, he expresses concerns with the Summit case and actually calls out to us to clarify what we mean in that case. Is that in some way a problem to your argument?
No, that was getting back to my argument about the sexual innocence inference.
Correct.
He was really concerned about when do we make that assumption. In Summit v. State, they had the luxury of having a juror come back and testify and say, well, this is what went on during deliberations and
mental processes, right? Etc.
And we don't have that luxury typically. So when would the judge take that inference and say, well, you know, this is a 14-year-old boy. The jury probably thought that 14-year-old boy was a sexual innocent. And that's probably not correct in today's day and age, but when should he take that inference and when should he not?
Thank you, counsel. Other questions?
Justice Seda?
Yes.
I had one more question, and it had to do with the Internet crimes, much the same question as I asked your opponent. Could you comment on what he's arguing about in terms of the alleged disconnect between, and I'm not well-versed in how these computer searches would have worked.
Yes, absolutely. Well, the testimony that we did have, the direct testimony, this wasn't just as the defendant argues, circumstantial evidence or propensity evidence. We had direct evidence that the defendant worked in an office with just two people, he and a secretary. His secretary testified that his computer was his own. She had gone on there one time to make a brochure, but other than that, she had never touched his computer. And no one else went into that office. It was just the two. We also had evidence from the headquarters in Texas that stated that they record everything that goes on in that office on each computer. And so the headquarters stated that we kept records of every site that his computer visited, and it was his computer, no one else's. And so there was direct evidence. Every website that was charged came directly from the work history that the parent company of his company in Texas recorded from his computer. They recorded every transaction, every Internet visit. And so it was direct evidence. It wasn't circumstantial. He argues that, well, there were pictures on the computer, but those pictures didn't match the websites. Really, that was circumstantial evidence, but you have a base, a foundation of very strong direct evidence as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I'd like to first just reply to that last question again. There was not direct evidence. Both experts testified that list would pop up if you went to a website and it had any links on it, any pictures on it, each one of those would show up on an individual website. So even if I went to website A and it had a link to website B, the computer would show me going to B even though I didn't go. If I was only on A and it had a link to B, and so neither of the experts could testify, and no one from the headquarters actually showed up because all they had was a statement to actually say, we know for certain that he went on this website. There was no evidence. It was all circumstantial and not direct. With regards to the standard that is being applied, I know in my brief, as I went through each individual argument, there was a standard. A lot of them are abuse of discretion. Some of them are harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. But as I went back and looked at Abbott, I thought that was most applicable here, just because the court starts off by saying that this is an abuse of discretion case. In the end, its conclusion states that The error is not harmless. It is not clear beyond a reasonable doubt that a rational jury would have found the defendant guilty absent the error. And I believe that's the applicable error here because we are dealing with a fundamental right of the defendant to present a fair trial, to present his evidence in defense, and to require the state to follow the applicable rules. In summary, as we go through all of these, the defendant did not have an opportunity to present a full defense. The state says, why should he get an opportunity to review? He got all these evidence. The state had the opportunity to sit down with the child and pretty much go through and get, they were going to keep, the officer actually admitted that she was going to keep that child there until she would get the answer that she wanted. Is that fair? Is that fair to a defendant? Is a defendant not having notice of an expert on child erotica and then being required to go through trial and not having any other opportunity to prepare, say, you're good to go? It's not fair. And based upon that, we'd ask that you reverse this case and remand it for a new trial.
Thank you very much. This matter will stand submitted. Thank you.